nights ranked in reverse order. Date night, medieval night, and number one, Sportsnet Tonight. Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Tonight along the Sportsnet Radio Network. George Russick, Josh Goldberg back together for the first time. And I literally have no idea when we did a show together last.
June, maybe?
Was it?
It's been a while. I would think, you know, I think probably June. It's been quite some time. Yeah, they got us, you know, working with other people, George. I know I've been mentioning, you know, it's been a while since we've done a show. I know you mentioned to me that it's been a while, and here we go. It's funny how that works out.
Yeah, it does. Do you miss Roger or Andy right now?
I always... I'll be diplomatic as always. I miss anyone who I'm not working with. I miss them, George. That's the God's honest truth.
That's beautiful. We have a busy program. Eric Pincus, Los Angeles Lakers writer, Bleacher Report, co-host of the Hollywood Hoops podcast, going to join us in a couple minutes. Loser franchises do loser things over and over and over again. And in times where 2020 has been so uncertain and it's been a year unlike any other, you just look at the NFL. The Lions blow a big lead. The Bengals miss a chip shot field goal. The Browns get their doors blown off. It's comforting to know, and teams like the Clippers can't advance to the conference final. It's comforting to know that at least there's some consistency. It's like that warm mom's apple pie that you've grown to love. You know it'll always be there for you. And those four teams continue to suck year in, year out, and have soul-crushing losses.
50 years without making it to the conference finals is
incredible.
Honestly, it's astonishing. And they've had their chances. I think it was 06. They were up 3-1 against Phoenix. They blew that. I believe they were up 3-1 against Houston a couple years ago. And then there was the Josh Smith, Corey Brewer threes in game 6. And then they blew that. And obviously the rest is history. And then I'm still in just bewilderment at the way, it's bad enough to blow the three games, but to have double digit leads in each of those ball games in the second half and to just disintegrate in each of those games. Maybe they were tired. I understand the load management, guys coming back after 4.5 months. Okay. Sure. I suppose, but all of these other teams are dealing with it. Nikola Jokic had COVID. He had it. Clippers players, nobody had COVID. There were lots of things. Loved ones were lost. Obviously, people are dealing with a variety of different issues right now, like we all are in 2020. But Jokic had COVID, recovered, dominated last night, and dominated the entire series. They had no answer. Yeah. And everyone talked how, this is such a well-built team, positionless basketball. They can switch. So much defensive versatility. You know what they couldn't do? Defend Nikola Jokic. They didn't have a point guard. They didn't get into their sets consistently on offense. It was a much more flawed team, I think, than everyone anticipated.
Yeah, and I think it was Raptors fans, I think, last night went to bed with a bit of a smile on your face. Because if Kawhi Leonard came back to the Raptors, and we'll ask Eric Pincus that question coming up, if Kawhi stayed with the Raptors, I think they win it. Well, why don't we ask him that question right now? Eric Pincus, Los Angeles Lakers writer, Bleacher Report, co-host of the Hollywood Hoops podcast. Eric, how are you?
Oh, not bad. I'm excited to see how this week goes. The playoffs are rolling. It's been fun.
Yeah, it has absolutely been fun. I wanted to ask you, if Kawhi Leonard decided to stay in Toronto and not go home to Los Angeles, do you think the Raptors would have repeated as champions?
I don't know if they would have repeated. I would have had them in the finals. In fact, I expected them still to be. I really thought that they would be in this round right here, and I thought they would be taking on the Heat and would have a real shot to beat them. So I would have had them in the finals. I'd have to think long and hard whether or not I thought they could beat the Lakers, but you could certainly argue it because Lakers had a tough time versus Toronto. I think that you could at least argue they'd be at the finals and they'd have a real shot.
So, you know, one of the things in the last, I guess, 13 months or so, or really the last couple of years when Kawhi first sort of made his intentions known that he didn't want to be in San Antonio, and then his whole process last year, was he got this and deserved reputation as being very calculating and cold and assassin-like, like he is on the court, in terms of his power brokering and his decision-making. And this seemed like a slam dunk move to go home and bring Paul George with him with that roster. But at least in year one, and I know there are caveats with the pandemic, it does seem like a bit of a miscalculation on his part that this roster was ready-made to win a championship. How do you feel on that?
Well, I don't know if they were anything close to ready-made, but they did do a good job of putting pieces together and then adding on guys like Marcus Morris midstream and Reggie Jackson. They just didn't have it this year, and it seemed like they could. I warned those who were willing to listen that they had some flaws. And in all of my analysis, either in writing or on radio or podcast form, I said that the weak spot is that this team has no point guard. And Lou Williams is the closest thing to that. But Lou, historically, as great of a regular season scorer as he's been, has struggled in the playoffs because you're not going up against reserves anymore. And you're not going up against coaches who only have a day or two to plan for you. In the playoffs, that's all the entire organization, you know, some of the best minds in basketball for any team. You know, they have great scouting departments and coaching staffs. They do all the homework. So Lou struggles in the playoffs. And if you take away what he can do, then you're taking away what Montrezl Harrell can do, because Montrezl is very dependent on that. And you take away any creation. And then it's really just Kawhi and Paul George and no one to really set them up. There's no true point guard. And you look at the Raptors, and you've got Kyle Lowry, and Lowry is not the most athletic player in the world. He's certainly not the tallest. But a point guard can be everything in the NBA. And you see the Lakers have had a huge boost from an older point guard in Rajon Rondo. Helped them get past the Rockets. It's a vital, vital piece. Someone on the floor who isn't necessarily maybe your best scorer, but is your best setup man. And I mean, man, if Lowry was on the Clippers, you said, what if Kawhi was still, with the Raptors, if you put, Lowry instead of Lou Williams on that team, or, Patrick Beverley and Lou Williams for Lowry, that changes that team right there is an entirely different thing, because Lowry's going to bring out the best of them and Kawhi is going to get those opportunities that he just couldn't create for himself.
I think the thing that struck me most in certainly last night and on and off throughout the playoffs and certainly in the last couple of games against Denver is that when Kawhi, tired a little bit, nobody really helped pick up the slack. It was all on him, it seemed like, at both ends of the floor. And you obviously look at Paul George, who for years and years has been looked at as one of the best two-way players in the league and a top 15 or 20 guy in the league. And he just... I know shoulder surgery and a shortened season, but he just never really looked comfortable playing with Kawhi. And that to me was very surprising.
Well, there were good stretches over the course of the season where the two of them just fit fine, but it never felt necessarily like there was a cohesive plan. I mean, it was a lot of freelancing. And again, I think that goes back to not really having a point guard, but this was a team that had four scorers, right? You had Montrezl and Lou, and you had Paul George and Kawhi. And a lot of times that was the combination that would finish out games. And the fifth player would be either a defender or a shooter. They could go big with Zubats. They could go small with whatever, Patrick Beverley, whatever they wanted to do. They had a lot of flexibility there, but there was no one to really create. And again, it didn't really matter that much during the regular season because they weren't going up against teams that really had the time to prepare. But it became clear pretty quickly, actually, when the Lakers took the Clippers a little bit more seriously than other teams, because they knew that, or at least they thought they knew in retrospect, that they had to get through them in the playoffs. So I watched the way that the Lakers attacked the Clippers, and they completely targeted Lou Williams on defense. Everything would be caught because the Clippers would switch on defense a lot. They would target Lou, and everybody would drive and attack him, or they would attack Montrez. And it really took away all those great things that you could say about Kawhi as a defender or Paul George. If they're not the ones who are in the play because the Lakers or, you know, in this case, the Nuggets aren't even attacking those players, it diminishes what they do defensively. And then, you know, Paul George, you know, I noticed throughout his tenure with the Clippers this year that sometimes he would light it up and sometimes he'd be like, wait, is he out there? I kind of forgot he was out there. He would go through long stretches without scoring. So, yeah, I think Kawhi is Kawhi. He did not play particularly well. I think some of that was that he didn't have enough help. But, again, he's not necessarily that Kyle Lowry-type leader, so it's not just the positional. But, you know, he's not the guy to rally the team and get everyone on the same page. And I think that is a flaw in who he is. You need someone – if you're the best player on the team, you need to drive the team and get them to where you need to be to win that game. And we just didn't see that.
Los Angeles Lakers writer for the Bleacher Report, co-host of the Hollywood Hoops podcast, Eric Pincus, joining us here, Sportsnet Tonight, George and Josh, along the Sportsnet Radio Network. Kawhi has 1 year left on his deal before he hits free agency again. He's not going to leave the Clippers, is he, Eric?
I mean, I can't say that either way. I mean, he definitely could leave the Clippers. He left the Raptors. He left the Spurs. And it's not like this was a happy feeling for the Clippers. It's not like they're sitting around feeling like we gave it our best shot and we just got beat by the better team. I think they truly believe they lost to a lesser team. I don't think that they believe that the Nuggets are better than them. If you play against LeBron, you play against, you know, the great Kobe, great late Kobe Bryant, or you play against Shaq or Tim Duncan, or there's sometimes you're just going to get beat. Like, there's nothing. You look at what the Raptors went through year after year, losing to LeBron James, and it was not fun, and it didn't make anyone feel great. But you were losing to an all-time great player, and then, you know, the moment he was gone, suddenly the Raptors win a championship. You know what I mean? I don't think that's when you're the Clippers. I don't think that's where they're at. I think they realize in their minds that they beat themselves. And, you know, the Nuggets would disagree and say, no, that we beat them. But I think the Clippers believe, and that's what matters here. And if you're Kawhi and you're sitting on that, what do you do? I mean, do you no longer have faith in the coaching staff? Does that mean that Steve Ballmer needs to make a change to appease Kawhi if Kawhi doesn't believe in Doc? And I'm not saying that's true or false. I'm just saying if that's the case. You know, does he not believe in Paul George anymore? Does he not believe in Lou Williams? You know, where is Kawhi's head at? And Kawhi is not, as we've discussed, not the most communicative guy. I'm curious if they're going to get that from him, and is he going to lay out what he needs, or is he just going to be like checked out and thinking about whatever's next for him?
Eric, when it comes to Kawhi, and obviously, yeah, maybe that's an unfair question by me because we don't know what he's going to do. Nobody really knows except for that tiny inner circle around Kawhi, which is airtight. But let's play that game where he decides to leave the Clippers as a free agent. We know that they gave away everything, their entire future, with that deal with the Oklahoma City Thunder. If he left, what kind of state would that franchise be in if he decides to leave, moving into a new arena eventually with potentially years of some bad basketball ahead?
Well, I mean, the NBA cycles through every 3 or 4 years. You can, you know, sort of reset. It helps to have picks, but not every team builds that way. Some teams are able to lure free agents. Maybe the Clippers would. If there was a sense that Kawhi was leaving, maybe they look to trade him. Again, I'm not speculating that the Clippers are trying to trade him. We're saying if Kawhi wanted to leave, maybe they're looking to trade him. Maybe they're looking to trade Paul George. Maybe they're going in different directions. And yeah, they're not operating from a place of strength, if that's the case. But we look at the Thunder and how they recovered. Not that they traded away a lot of picks, but they had Kevin Durant leave. And then they were kind of forced to trade Paul George, and that led to trading Russell Westbrook, and then yet they were a really, really good team this year. So the NBA is so unpredictable. I'm not going to sit here and say that they're doomed if Kawhi leaves, but this is devastating for the Clippers because they had every expectation that they would face the Lakers. They believed that that was a good matchup for them, and that, yeah, it wasn't a certainty that they would beat LeBron and AD and all that, but they felt like they had a really good chance to do that, and if they did do that, they would get to the finals. Felt pretty good about that as well. And now suddenly they're on vacation. Yeah, that's that's a lot to reconcile.
And, you know, they're in a pretty tough spot because, like we're talking about, both those guys only have 1 year left on their deals before they can go back to free agency if they so choose. And I understand, you know, you always look, well, how can you make this team better when you have a disappointing end to the season? But, like, how do you kind of weigh trying to figure out a way to improve somehow with limited assets versus cautioning and maybe saying, you know what, let's bring everyone back a regular season if we do get one, and see if this team, like the Heat in 2011, can come back in a second year with more time together to gel and become the team that everyone anticipated.
Right. Well, it's a matter of meeting. You know, does management meet with Kawhi and what does he say that he wants? Is Doc Rivers the coach to, you know, is that what Kawhi wants? You know, it becomes like, are you making moves to keep Kawhi, or are you then making moves that maybe you don't believe in and then Kawhi leaves anyway? You know, it's a very difficult circumstance. Players who take shorter contracts have more power. I think LeBron James showed that, where he took a series of one-year deals to sort of push the teams, whether it be the Heat or the Cavaliers, to do his bidding, you know, to build the team the way that he wanted, to make sure that J.R. Smith got paid and Tristan Thompson. You know, there's a lot of player power, and I don't have a problem with it because, you know, teams are willing to trade players left and right, so why shouldn't players have power as well? So it's a very complex issue. The Clippers have to do everything they can to improve this. I don't think they're that far off from it. I mean, like I said, if you had Lowry in there, not that Lowry's available, but if you had Lowry instead of these guys like Lou or Patrick Beverley, and he was your leader, and now you're playing with Paul George and Kawhi and role players, now I think you're in a much better place. But so, you know, there may be one piece away, but the one piece away might be an all-star point guard like, you know, Kyle Lowry. That's not an easy thing to do.
Eric, for those of us who don't live in Southern California, where are the Clippers on the Los Angeles sports radar?
So there are a lot of transplants in Los Angeles. A lot of people came to Los Angeles from the East Coast, and they grew up hating the Lakers because they're from Boston, or maybe they're from New York, or whatever it is. They cannot love the Lakers. They have to hate the Lakers. And because of that, they love basketball. They want to root for the other team. So some of it is transplants. Homegrown Laker fans are the norm. I mean, I would say a small percentage of people who grew up in L.A. are also, you know, are specifically Clipper fans and not Laker fans. Maybe it's 5 to 8%. Maybe it's 10% at its peak. I don't even think it's that. But, if, you know, if we want to be generous, there was a tremendous celebration in Los Angeles by Laker fans for the early coronation of the Clippers as the best team in the league, or the best team in the West, and their sudden failure and inability to get to the conference finals. Twitter was hysterical. You know, unless you're a Clipper fan, people in the NBA, players were just ragging on, you know, it's a difficult situation. You know, I appreciate the organization for where they come from, which is a very bad place under Donald Sterling, to what Steve Ballmer has made them. So I have a lot of respect for a lot of people who work there and for what the organization is doing. You know, that's me. You know, the fans, the casual fans or the diehard Laker fans don't share that same respect.
You know, so looking at the next series with the Lakers and Nuggets, everyone's been kind of going on this, the bracket has opened up for the Lakers and now the championship is theirs to lose. And I guess I see that. But at the same time, you know, what can Denver do at both ends of the floor, particularly offensively, that could make this a difficult series and perhaps, you know, even upset the Lakers in a seven-game series?
Sure. Well, I mean, you start with the non-basketball aspect of just being resilient, of just not quitting. This is a team that went down 3-1 twice and was able to push back, which is unheard of in the NBA, and it's never been done like that. So we could talk about the X's and O's, but ultimately you have to have the heart for this, and I think that's where people are looking at the Clippers and asking, did they have the heart for this season, for this championship? Obviously, they didn't win. Maybe they didn't have the heart for it. The Nuggets, they have that. from X's and O's, their offense, they have 2 points of attack. Like if you're a defensive team like the Lakers and you're going to try to figure out how to stop them, where do they, how do they run their offense? Who is it, who are they running it through? And it's all going through Jokic, Nikola Jokic, mostly in the high post around the elbows or, you know, around the free throw line area. And what's fascinating is that he's their best passer. He's essentially their point guard out of the center position where the ball gets to him and everybody runs around. They have cuts and they do all, you know, it's really fun to watch. And it's unusual, not just in today's NBA, certainly in today's NBA, but even historically there have been, you know, Marc Gasol did some of that. But there are, it's just not that common to run your offense through a center. And then they have a Jamal Murray, who's a tremendous scorer and in a similar way to like Damian Lillard, willing to pull up from all kinds of areas on the floor with jump shots that are probably bad shots based on you know, true understanding of the game and history. But if you can make those shots at a high percentage, they are good shots, right? So, you know, for the Lakers, they need to really make Jamal Murray uncomfortable, and I think they have the personnel to do that. And then they have the size that the Clippers didn't have. You know, Dwight Howard and JaVale McGee didn't even really play in this last series against the Rockets. They play a much more prominent role because the Lakers, at least in my expectation, do not want to double team Nikola Jokic. You double team him and he's such a good passer. He's hitting everybody in cutters and shooters, and now you're opening up a whole can of worms there. So, you know, it's going to take perfect execution. I don't know if the Nuggets are a good enough defensive team to handle the Lakers. I've been shocked at how good they have been to this point, but I don't know how they beat the Lakers on paper, but I didn't think they were coming back against the Clippers.
Eric, we know heading into the playoffs, a lot was made about the Lakers' depth or lack thereof, and it obviously didn't rear its head in the series against the Blazers or the Rockets. Does it here against the Nuggets potentially, or even in an NBA Finals matchup against the Celtics or Heat?
Well, I mean, I guess maybe we got used to the idea of a big three because we saw LeBron had three and the Warriors had three. LeBron played with Kyrie and Love, or he played with Bosch and Wade. And then the Warriors had KD along with Steph and Clay and Draymond. But that historically is pretty rare. I mean, maybe if you go back far enough, there, you know, there were times where that was much more common. But in recent history, you know, it's you get a couple of stars like Kobe and Shaq, or, you know, I guess some of the, we could look through the Celtics certainly had more than, you know, they had Garnett and Ray Allen and Paul Pierce. So it's not entirely uncommon. But two stars, when one of them is LeBron James, who's arguably the best player of his generation and one of the best players of all time, and then Anthony Davis, who's not yet proven but has the potential to be, you know, better than at least when you talk LeBron, better than Kevin Love, better than Chris Bosh. But there isn't a Dwayne Wade. There isn't a Kyrie Irving. And so, no, you know, the Lakers don't have a third star, but the Coach Vogel, Frank Vogel, has said the third option or the third star is whoever is open. This is not a deep team when it comes to scoring, to creating offense off the dribble. You know where the ball's coming from. Coming from LeBron, and, you know, they have Alex Caruso who could do a little bit. Rajon Rondo is the other point of attack as the point guard, and then everything's through Anthony Davis. Everything else, though, is really shooters who are not great shooters. Kuzma is a flashy scorer. He can do some things. But really the identity of this team is depth on the defensive end, and I think that's where you know, pundits and experts have missed the boat. They are not that deep offensively, but they are very deep defensively. They really have a lot of good players who can do a lot of things and they're very long. There's size at every position. They're tough and physical. Guys like Markieff Morris and Danny Green and, you know, like I said, Caruso. And, you know, there aren't a lot of weaknesses. There's nobody out there who's going to mess up their defense because they're not on the same page. They're well coached. So, you know, there is depth. They're far, you know, much deeper than the Nuggets when it comes to defensive depth, by far. They have the same level of offensive shooting and scoring as the Nuggets. Not in depth, but at the top, I'd say that if you say AD and Nikola Jokic are on par, I would say that LeBron's certainly better than Jamal Murray, even though Jamal Murray arguably has been one of the best players in the entire bubble.
Eric Pincus, Los Angeles Lakers writer for the Bleacher Report, co-host of the Hollywood Hoops podcast. Eric, great stuff tonight. Thanks for this.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
There he goes. Nikola Jokic, best lunch lady arm player since Dirk Nowitzki. Yeah. I don't think it's even close, Josh.
He's more dumpy than even at Dirk Nowitzki's, like, kind of doughiest or whatever. Yeah, he's got those flabby arms. Like, he's not shredded by any means. He's not super athletic. He's pretty agile. He's got quick feet. And the passing is just, it's outrageous. Like, he makes at least three just kind of, like, takes your breath away. Great reads, like somebody cutting, an alley-oop, something like that. And the Murray-Jokic screen and roll is, you know, like, that's going to be a real problem for the Lakers. Like, the Lakers can beat Denver up inside because Jokic isn't much of a shot blocker, and Anthony Davis and LeBron should be able to kind of live in the paint. But I don't think this is going to be some walkover series. Like, there's anyone who's, like, just saying, oh, yeah, the Lakers are going to romp in five. Maybe that does happen, but you'd be foolish to just assume that the Nuggets are going to go down here pretty meekly, unless the Lakers just overwhelm them, which right. I suppose is possible. I expect this series to be pretty competitive and a lot of these games to be pretty tight down the stretch of fourth quarters.
Could you imagine if Jokic restarted his career with Portland, if he worked out with the Blazers, with McCollum and Lillard, what that team would look like?
Yeah, well, it's just like, it's interesting that, you know, so many teams were just like, you know what, I don't know, like this big unathletic kid from Serbia, like, what am I doing here? Like, what kind of project are we talking about? 40 teams end up passing on him. And, you know, the Denver chose him over Nurkic, and then they shipped Nurkic to Portland. Like, you know, maybe it could have very easily, ended up he gets shipped and they build around Nurkic and Murray instead. But, you know, nobody in their right mind ever would have expected this kind of player. Like, the game he had, what was it, 16, 22, and 13. Like, you hear that stat line, and you're just like, what year is it that a big man
right.
is putting up these kinds of numbers? Like, that's like kind of Bill Russell-esque in some capacity. Like, those rebounds, those assists, he was making plays defensively. And that's really the most impressive part for me of the series against the Clippers, is it was always, well, you can attack Jokic defensively, you can get him out of position, he's reaching, you can take advantage of him. I thought he actually held up pretty well defensively when he got switched on to playoff P or Kawhi or any small. I thought he did a good job. He rotated effectively, wasn't on skates like he can be sometimes. And I think that, as much as anything, bodes well for Denver's chances against the Lakers.
It is 11:28 Sportsnet tonight. George and Josh along the Sportsnet Radio Network. Straight ahead, Eric Patterson, golf writer for The Score, will join us. The second major of the year is going to happen at what looks like an impossible golf course, Wingfoot. We'll talk about that straight ahead, what we like to potentially win this tournament. And later on this hour, Josh, I went back to the gym for the first time since March. I've been working out, but not physically in a gym for the first time since March. And I got some stories.
Okay.
We'll do that later on this hour. And at midnight, Benjamin Albright, host, NFL reporter, analyst for KOA Radio in Colorado, will look around the National Football League. It's all straight ahead. Sportsnet tonight, George and Josh, along the Sportsnet Radio Network. Sportsnet tonight along the Sportsnet Radio Network. My name is George Russick alongside Josh Goldberg. We're here till 1 a.m. later on this hour. Gym stories with George Russick, Benjamin Albright, host, NFL reporter, analyst for KOA Radio in Colorado. We'll talk about that Thursday nighter tomorrow between the Bengals and the Browns, and we'll preview the rest of week two from the National Football League. But we got a major. The U.S. Open starting tomorrow at Wingfoot. Eric Patterson covers the golf for The Score. To follow Eric's in-depth golf coverage, download The Score app and follow him on Twitter, @epatgolf. Eric Patterson, how are you? Thanks for this.
I'm doing well. I'm excited. It is weird to have a major championship in the middle of September, but 2020 has been a weird year, so here we are.
A lot's been made. We've seen the caddy videos of just dropping the ball and the ball rolls off the green. We've seen the Arnold Palmer can disappear in the ridiculously thick rough. Does it get out of hand? Does the USGA just lose their mind when it comes to this tournament? And just, it's beyond fair. It's an impossible golf course.
They know how to push the course to its limits. I'll give them that. It would be impossible for someone like me or the general Sunday weekend warrior to go out there and try and play this. But for these guys, they're going to put a premium on keeping the ball in the fairway. And if they can do that, then they will they'll be flirting with even par, which is a respectable winning score. The last two Open U.S. Opens that they've had at Wingfoot was a 7-over and 5-over. So I would expect something around there. And as long as they put the pins in locations that these guys can still make putts, then there shouldn't be too many complaints.
Well, the whole talk about the U.S. Open, and rightly so, is that it tests every facet of your game. And that's why it's always so tough for me to pick out, you know, whose game sets up the best. Like, who does everything well? Right? Like, the guys who drive it well, can they hit enough fairways? You know, putters, are they going to be on greens, you know, putting for par or birdie, or are they going to have to be saving bogeys? Like, how do you kind of look at, you know, some of the cream of this field and how their games, as it currently, I guess, how they've currently been playing, stacks up on such a challenging setup?
Yeah, it goes beyond just playing golf. Like, these guys go out, they can play any course and shoot, you know, 10 under, but there's such a mental approach, a wear on them mentally. Like, this is just going to be a grind for 72 holes. And I think, you need experience. Obviously, you need to be playing extremely well. The two guys who were the favorites, I would say, going in are Dustin Johnson and John Rahm. DJ just came off an incredible playoff performance. He won the FedEx Cup. He just won the Player of the Year. Apparently, he's looking incredible already at Wingfoot. So I would expect DJ to be up there. And same goes for John Rahm. He's never won a major, but he has won two of the hardest tournaments in this previous season, so of 2020, he's won two extremely tough tests. He has everything. If you're going to give me one pick, John Rahm would be it. He can hit it longer than most guys. He's incredible with his irons. His short game's really, really good, and he's a really good putter. So John Rahm would be my pick, but I think, yeah, you really do need every single aspect of your game firing.
Does this course just kind of mitigate some of those huge bombers? Because we've seen them take advantage of a lot of golf courses now, but you have to be ridiculously accurate off the tee and Wingfoot. Is that going to be the difference in this tournament? Not just guys like Bryson who hit it 425 yards and just get it as close to the hole as possible?
So Bryson is one of the more interesting characters for this week, because everyone is talking about how you got to keep it in the fairway. Rory's talking about how he's going to hit less than driver on a lot of holes, just, you know, keep it in the fairway. But Bryson was saying he is going to hit it as far as he possibly can, and he'll go try and find his ball. And he thinks with all this added strength, all this added swing speed, that the rough won't be thick for him. So if he is in the rough, he'll have a pitching wedge in, and he thinks he'll be okay. I personally don't think that's going to work for him. I'm very excited to see how his round is going to go tomorrow and see if he changes his strategy. But from every press conference I've listened to, all the professionals who are out there talking about the course, they really are just saying, you know, keep it in the fairway, keep the ball in front of you. And Bryson is apparently going to do something completely different. So I'm excited to see that.
Yeah, like when I hear that, and then I hear Rory say he's not going to be hitting driver as much, I just feel like we're going to see some really wacky stuff, right? Like, we're going to see guys hitting, I would imagine, irons off of tees, but like, I don't really even know how you would go about approaching a 7,500 yard par 70. Like, there just doesn't seem to be like a good strategy. I don't really know if there is such a thing as this strategy. I guess it's really just comes down to survival.
Yeah, I mean, surviving is a perfect way to put it. I guess this is going to date my, this is going way back, but there was a par three in 1974 that apparently Billy Casper, he laid up to every, for all four rounds. So he just played it for a bogey and moved on. Apparently Nick Faldo has done something similar where if you put the ball in the rough, you just take your bogey and you move on. So these guys, it is just about mitigating that big number. Don't make doubles. Don't make triples. A bogey will probably be a pretty good score in a lot of holes, which is crazy to say for some of the best players in the world, but it's going to be a grind. There's going to be whoever makes the most 10-foot putts, you know, saving par, even if it is a rare birdie, I think that's going to be a massive key as well. So it's the one week a year where we really see these guys push to their limits, and I don't need to see this every week. I don't think the PGA Tour pros would hate to do this every week, but it is the ultimate test. And, you know, if these guys are complaining about it, then that's, you know, that's more drama, more added excitement for me, at least.
He's a golf writer for The Score, Eric Patterson, joining us here, Sportsnet tonight. George and Josh along the Sportsnet radio network. A name that keeps coming up, that when is he going to finally win that major again? And Rory McIlroy hasn't won one since 2014. Does this feel like a course that Rory can't win because it's so ridiculously hard? Because I feel like Rory wins tournaments when it's a birdie fest.
Yeah, it's an interesting, I understand that story. He has won a bunch of majors he's won two majors by over 8 strokes. So, like, is it really his fault that the next guy behind him wasn't as close as, you know, how low he was going? So, McIlroy, he honestly is almost flying under the radar a bit this week, which is not a situation he's used to. Just has a brand new baby daughter at home. So golf might not be his number one priority, but at the same time, that could help, you know, relax him, change his mindset a little bit, maybe not stress as much as he would or put as much pressure on himself as he would on a major in the last couple of years. So if he is adapting to the course and he's not just hitting driver all over the place, I think he could contend. He would have to play his best golf he's played all season, which might not be the best place to do it at Wingfoot, but I wouldn't say he can't win because the score is going to be over par. I just think he's going to have to play a lot better than what he's been playing recently.
I know there's been some action betting-wise on Tiger because it feels like anytime there's a major and Tiger's, you know, not one of the favorites, people want to dive in case he has one of those weeks. But I don't know about you. I just can't see any way with, you know, the infrequency of him playing tournament golf the last couple months and this setup that there's any way that he's, you know, a made cut for me would be a good week. Where are you on Tiger?
Yeah, it does pain me to say that I'm in that camp as well, where if he does make the cut, I would almost be a little surprised because of how you got to be sharp at Wingfoot, and his game is not sharp right now. Off the tee, he doesn't hit it far enough to be how inaccurate he is, and he doesn't hit enough fairways to kind of make up for that loss in distance. So, and his putter's been extremely ice cold recently. So if he's not hitting fairways and he's not making putts, and the weather is probably not supposed to be super warm, so he might have some struggles with the stiff back that he's been dealing with for years and years. I'm not optimistic. I hate to say that, but if I'm seeing Tiger play on Saturday, I'll be happy, but I just don't expect him to contend.
Eric, what's a better bet? Just Xander Schauffele at 14-1 or Colin Morikawa to win back-to-back at 17-1?
Yeah, when you say, like, to win, if Morikawa didn't win the PGA Championship, I might lean towards him just because his game fits this perfectly. I actually just read a quote about Morikawa. They asked him what his worst lie was during the practice rounds, and he said, "I've only been in the rough once." Which bodes well for this week because the guy is extremely accurate. He's one of the better long iron players. But I really do like Schauffele. If you look at his U.S. Open track record, he's played it 3 times, and his worst finish is a top six. Like, he tied for sixth in 2018, I believe. So that is an incredible 3-year stretch. He loves these tough courses. He's playing really well. So I would go with Schauffele because I do think winning back-to-back majors, regardless of who you are, is extremely difficult and rare.
So there's a couple of, I guess, Englishmen that are interesting values for me. Like Tommy Fleetwood has played well at the U.S. Open before. Tyrrell Hatton's had a great year. Justin Rose has won a U.S. Open. And Matthew Fitzpatrick is maybe the best hard course player right now in the world. Seems to always show up on tough tracks. So of those four, who do you like value-wise? And realistically, who do you think is most likely to be there with a chance to win on Sunday?
Wow, you're reading some of the same stuff I'm reading because I really like Fitzpatrick this week. You mentioned it, plays hard courses really well, keeps the ball in the fairway, has a world class short game and putter. So if par's a good score, Fitzpatrick knows how to make pars better than most people. So I think he would probably be the longest odds wise of those Englishmen that you laid out. So. Fitzpatrick, he doesn't hit it far. I think he averages less than 300 off the tee, which in today's game is very short. But apparently you're not supposed to need that this week. So Fitzpatrick would be my pick of that group with Tyrrell Hatton a close second. Fleetwood and Rose just haven't really been playing as well as I would expect them to have played coming into the U.S. Open. And, honestly, you're not going to find it this week. You're not just going to have a miraculous week at this tough of a course, because if you haven't been playing well coming in, you're not going to find it. You're not going to work out your kinks on one of the toughest courses in the world.
Eric Patterson covers golf for The Score. Follow Eric's in-depth golf coverage. Download The Score app and follow him on Twitter at epatgolf. Eric, thanks for this. Enjoy the golf, pal.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me on.
There it goes, Josh. Outside of Eldrick winning the U.S. Open, who's the guy you'd like to see winning?
It's a tough one.
Let's put gambling aside.
Yeah.
Who would you want to root for?
Because if it's gambling, it's Tyrrell Hatton, because I got him at a good number a while ago. But yeah, independent of that, I think Rory winning would be great, in all honesty.
Really?
I just feel like, he's long been kind of one of the good guys of the game. Not that there are bad guys of the game. He's a good ambassador for the game of golf, right? He's always pretty open and honest. I like that. I know Brooks Koepka's kind of the villain. For me, Rory's kind of the mirror image of Brooks in a lot of ways. They're kind of polar opposites. And just, the storyline of the father, he hasn't won a major in 6 years. His game hasn't been in terrific shape, even though he did have a decent week in Atlanta at the Tour Championship. That would be a pretty cool one for me. Other than that, there's nobody one of the young guns. If Wolf were to win, or Hovland were to win, or obviously Morikawa was to win again, that would be great. And honestly, I think what would piss a lot of people off, which I might be down for, is if Bryson wins, because I'm not sure how people would handle him winning any major, let alone the U.S. Open, which is the one I feel like a lot of people would just be like, well, with the way he plays, there's no way he could win, let alone contend. That would be one just for the indignation of the golf community, writers, everyone who follows the game. If he were to win the U.S. Open, I'm not sure what the storyline would be coming from some of these recap articles.
It wouldn't be the 50-year-old Phil Mickelson completing the career Grand Slam.
Yeah, I thought about that. It's just realistically, there's no chance. I would say I'll give him a 1% chance, because statistically you have to. I think last week in Napa at the Safeway, he was one of the worst accuracy, in terms of hitting fairways off the tee. You've got no chance if you're not hitting fairways. And Phil likes to bomb drivers. It cost him at Winged Foot in 06. I just don't really think he has the right sort of setup for his game to have any modicum of success at this stage of his career at 50.
Well, apparently, according to Darren Revelle and William Hill, somebody put down, Josh, $45,000 on Phil Mickelson at 75-1.
Yeah.
That ticket's worth $3.375 million.
Good luck to you.
If you have $45,000 to put on Phil Mickelson, money is no object whatsoever.
Yeah,
That's obscene. straight ahead. I returned to the gym for the first time in this pandemic. We'll talk about that at the top of the clock. Lots of NFL talk. Benjamin Albright, host, NFL reporter, analyst for KOA Radio in Colorado. And Josh will debut a new segment. We'll talk about that as well. It's all straight ahead. Sportsnet tonight, George and Josh, along the Sportsnet Radio Network. Sportsnet tonight along the Sportsnet Radio Network. George Russick, Josh Goldberg here till 1 a.m. Eastern. Straight ahead, Benjamin Albright, host, NFL reporter, analyst for KOA Radio in Colorado. We'll look around week 2 of the National Football League. Straight ahead, we're going to debut a new segment as well. Josh, you and I did confirm or deny for the NFL. I think probably 3 years ago we started that segment. Mm-hmm. And there's another show in Toronto that does a similar segment. And we get tweets, oh, you guys are ripping these guys off. You and I have done it well before any other show. So I decided, forget, you know, original, forget people stealing our ideas. We're going to get super crazy original. We're going to debut the newest segment, Goldie Berg and the Serbian Bear, where we give you current fairy tales from the League of National Football. Are you excited?
I am excited. Yeah, it's a new spin on an NFL-centric segment. The takes are always strong when we talk NFL. So, yeah, I'm ready to go. I got a couple of smokers ready for you.
Yeah, we will do that at 12:25. But first, we're obviously all still in a pandemic. Cases in Ontario continue to rise at an alarming rate. And you're hearing whispers of maybe Ontario's going to go back a stage and start shutting things down again. But I was reluctant to go back to the gym. But seeing the lack of cases in the Niagara region, Josh, I decided to go back to the gym for the first time tonight. I have been working out at Oaks Park in Niagara Falls outside because, to me, I feel very comfortable during a pandemic doing stuff outdoors. You're not locked in. The air is blowing. Everything's fine. Fresh air. Great. So I decided to go to the gym today. And the gym I went to, I'm not going to give it the name, but you have to book your session ahead of time online, because what they do is they clean between sessions. They clean the entire gym every time between sessions, which is fantastic. And going in, you have to wear a mask. I wore my mask the entire time. Now, here's the issue. Half the people in there weren't wearing a mask, Josh.
Yeah.
And when I was banging the weights, trying to get swole, there was a woman beside me working out, really difficult, no mask, and just going,
oh God.
Yeah, I wasn't comfortable. Like, I'm not, you know me, and it's well documented on these shows that I am a bit of a germaphobe, and my life really hasn't changed during the pandemic. I'm still as crazy about hand washing and sanitizer as I've been throughout my pretty much adult life. But having that person beside me, she was about 6 feet away. I'm like, come on, man. And it's not like I'm going to go over and tell you, put on a mask. That's not my job. It's the people of the club to tell you to wear a mask. And then you have the people who wear their mask halfway, like it's not covering their nose. What's even the point of that? Should I have said something to her?
You know, like, I have had situations indoors where somebody hasn't been wearing a mask, and I did say something, and you know, it wasn't received particularly well.
Okay,
is all that I'll say. You know, it didn't lead to anything serious or anything like that. But that's the risk you weigh, right? I understand we should all have respect for each other and wear the mask like we've been told to. But like, it's not my job necessarily to police that. It's a tough one. Like, I on the one hand, you want to do it because you're being directly impacted, but especially in a gym, like, there are employees there, staff, security, whatever it is, that's their job. So why should you have to do their job for them? It's on them to do it. If anything, I'd say something to them. I'd rather snitch than just outright do it myself, and who knows what kind of situation we might get ourselves into.
Yeah, it's just it was one of those instances where I had a good workout, felt good after, but I'm like,
Are you going to go back? Debating it?
I don't know yet. Maybe? I don't know. It's weird. Because the weather's not going to hold up for much longer, right? Probably good another good month of outdoor working out, and then
yeah,
we start to head into some crappy weather.
Yeah.
So
it's a tough call.
Put your mask on if you're going to the gym. That's the long and short of it. All right.
Put your mask on, period.
Yeah, in public. Yes. Absolutely. And please, don't wear your mask while you're driving by yourself in the car. That's just weird. Like, who are you protecting? You're protecting yourself from yourself? Like, if you're in the car by yourself, it's not necessary to wear a mask.
Agreed.
Stop being a weirdo, everybody.
Yeah.
If you're one of those people who wears their mask in the car, stop doing it. It's weird. The virus is not going to somehow go through your car and through the vents and into your face. Like, stop it. Anyway, Benjamin Albright, host, NFL reporter, analyst for KOA Radio in Colorado. We'll preview week two, and we'll do Goldieberg and the Serbian Bear. It's all straight ahead. Sportsnet tonight. George and Josh along the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Don't get left in the dark. Let us shine a light on everything you need to know. This is Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Tonight along the Sportsnet Radio Network. My name is George Russick alongside Josh Colbert. Later on this hour, the debut of a new brand new segment at 12:25. And at the end of the program, if you're feeling a little hungry, a little peckish, a little snacky, Mark Boffo is the producer of this program, and he'll join us for Boffo's Buffet of Topics. But right now, week two kicks off in Cleveland tomorrow between the Bengals and the Browns. To talk about that game and the rest of the week two slate, Benjamin Albright, host, NFL reporter, and analyst for KOA Radio in Colorado. Benjamin, how are you?
I am doing all right. How about yourselves?
We're great. Thanks for jumping on tonight. We know that the Cleveland Browns, well, I was telling Josh this earlier. We know 2020 has been such an unpredictable year of really highs and really lows, but it was comforting to me, Benjamin, to notice that the Lions gagged away a big lead, the Bengals missed an easy field goal and lost, and the Browns got their doors blown off by an elite team. At least there's some, you know, comfort in knowing that bad teams continue to just lose and shoot themselves in the foot in the National Football League.
Oh, yeah. The more things change, the more they stay the same, right? It's good to have the familiar comfort of mom's apple pie and bad teams managing to find ways to lose in the NFL.
Yeah, and like I don't really know, you know, what it is with Cleveland. Like, they have lots of talent. They made lots of moves in the offseason, you know, to bolster the line. They brought in Hooper, and Baltimore's a tough test. There's no question about that. But it was pretty rocky. Odell, a lot of uncatchable targets. Like, you know, what's your level of concern that Baker Mayfield's rookie season was kind of just a blip, and maybe he's not really all that good?
I think he can return to form. You got to remember, he's again learning another new offense, new offensive coordinator, all that kind of stuff. It's going to take him a little while to get in the groove of what they need. And the fact that you didn't have a preseason to kind of iron some of that out really hurts a lot of these teams, especially in the pass game. So, you know, I'm not as concerned about that. We saw a lot of sloppy passing, I think, over the weekend. Some of the teams picked it up fairly well, but most of those had some sense of continuity, you know, same offensive pieces, same offensive coordinator, that kind of stuff. So I'm not super concerned about it. We get to the end of this year and he's still looking like that, then we got something to talk about.
Well, Benjamin, there's reports out there that Case Keenum and the second team offense has looked fantastic in camp, and they're even roasting the first team offense, putting pressure on Baker Mayfield. Where does Kevin Stefanski get to the point where if Baker continues to struggle, he thinks about putting Case Keenum in because they spent a ton of money to bring him into Cleveland?
Well, it would have to get really bad, I think, before it gets to that point. The other part of this is Case Keenum should look good. He spent the majority of his career in that offense. He was drafted by signed by Gary Kubiak after he went undrafted. And then, you know, played the Denver Broncos in the same offense. So, you know, he's played in that kind of that same boot action wide zone offense nearly his entire career, where Baker Mayfield is getting it for the first time, really. So Case Keenum should look good in it. If Baker doesn't get it by midseason, then maybe you start to look at that. Maybe you start to say, you know what, we need to make a change and go from there.
I want to ask you about the Bills because, you know, Josh Allen finally has a 300-yard game for the first time in his career. But social media was still, you know, he missed a throw in the end zone and everyone was all over him. You know, same old erratic Josh Allen. You know, what did you make of how he looked and how, I guess, really that whole offense looked in week one?
Well, my preseason pick to square off against Kansas City in the AFC Championship was Buffalo. I'm all the way in with them. So, you know, I think they're a good football team. Josh is a little bit erratic at times. That's been a knock on him dating back to high school. But the more comfortable he gets in this offense and the more the game slows down for him, the better he'll be. You know, who amongst us hasn't missed a wide-open receiver before? You know, I'm quite sure that if you go back and look, you could even find Aaron Rodgers having done that once. So I'm not super, super concerned about it. They won the game. He put up a high yardage total. And they've got a great defense to rely on. As the game slows down for him and as he gets more in the groove, I think they'll be fine.
Benjamin Albright, host, NFL reporter, analyst for KOA Radio in Colorado, joining us here on Sportsnet tonight, George and Josh, along the Sportsnet Radio Network. We know in the AFC, and you're putting the Bills there in the upper echelon with the Chiefs and, of course, the Ravens, but where do the Steelers fit into all of this, Benjamin? We know that Ben Roethlisberger looked good in his return, and we know that defense is one of the best units in not only the AFC, but in the NFL as a whole. How much damage do you think the Steelers can do, and do you think they can potentially knock off a Baltimore and Kansas City in the playoffs?
Well, I picked them to win the division, which means I may have undersold on Baltimore a little bit. But I think they're a very good football team. We're going to get a chance to see how close and personal is coming week in Denver when the Broncos to take them on. That front seven on the defense looks particularly lethal. I think they're a little exploitable in the secondary if the pass rush doesn't get home. We saw Slayton kind of have his way with that secondary on Monday night, but you know, they look like a good team, and the more confidence Ben gets coming back from that injury, the more it's going to be. I thought Benny Snell was really better running than Kyler was anyway. It's going to be interesting to see how they divvy up that run game going forward, but they're a good football team. They've got weapons that can challenge you at every level, and the defense is going to shout at anybody.
So I want to ask specifically about Denver, since you're based in Denver and on the radio there in Denver. Drew Lock coming into this season was definitely an interesting quarterback to keep an eye on, to see how he would, you know, kind of take a step forward, see if he could take a step forward in his second year. What'd you make of his first week? You know, encouraging signs, discouraging signs, kind of put it into context for us.
Well, I thought it looked pretty good. I mean, there were some misses, and we knew there were going to be some misses for a guy at his sixth start. He missed a wide open tight end in the end zone. He hits that pass, all of a sudden we're talking about a 21-16 game. We're not having the same conversation. They didn't punch it in on 4th-and-1 there. That would have been 21-16. We're talking about a different conversation there. So I thought overall it looked pretty good. He had some issues with the deep passing game. But again, that goes back to what I was talking about earlier. With no preseason and teams with a new offensive coordinator and young players, you just don't get games to iron that out. And that's what happens. You get sloppy football early in the season. Your offense doesn't have the timing down specifically on the deep stuff, and you know, you're seeing that borne out a little bit across the league.
Ben, I was super impressed with Jerry Jeudy. I know he had a couple drops that he should have held on to, but I know this is a big time comparison. I just want to get your thoughts with his quickness and foot speed and how elusive he looks on his routes. He reminds me of Antonio Brown. Is that too crazy for me?
You know, I would suggest that's not too crazy, although, you know, Antonio Brown, the person, might be a little bit too crazy.
Right.
Not something the Denver Broncos would want to take on. Right. I do. It's interesting to me because Jerry Jeudy, for all the athleticism and everything else, I think the thing that sold on me was the fact that he understands the craft of playing wide receiver at a level far beyond his years. You know, I've never seen somebody come into the league as adept at route running, who understands gearing down mid-route and switching direction, who understands the technical aspects of playing wide receiver. came into the league. And so, you know, when Jerry does finally put it all together, he's going to be something special. Antonio Brown, I think that's a great comparison in terms of being on the field player.
I want to ask you about Dallas, because coming into the season, you know, a talented roster, they've already got a ton of injuries on both sides of the ball. But everyone was like, well, is Mike McCarthy really the guy that's going to get the most out of this roster, you know, the way it ended in Green Bay? And he had talked about how he was embracing analytics and looking at things differently. And, you know, you don't want to throw the book at him in week one, but I certainly didn't think it was a particularly good debut. What did you make of how Dallas looked under McCarthy, particularly on offense?
Well, I mean, you got to remember they got some continuity there with Kellen Moore carrying it over on the offensive coordinator and calling the plays. I like Mike McCarthy. I think he's a good coach. I always thought he got kind of a raw deal in Green Bay because everybody was glomming on, you know, how great Aaron Rodgers was, and he is great. But, you know, they didn't give McCarthy the respect I think he deserved as well, because I thought that marriage was a pretty good one until it fell apart. McCarthy had problems hiring defensive coordinators, and that really bit him, and staying loyal to Dom Capers too long certainly bit him. But, you know, I thought they were okay. Dak Prescott to me is a guy who reminds me more of Alex Smith than anything else. You know, he can make the underneath passes. He can if you can get the wide receivers open in space, he can get them the ball. You put a strong run game of defense behind him, he's going to look really good. But I don't think he's carrying a team at any point. And I think that's the thing. I think that's the quandary Dallas is in right now is, do you pay that guy, you know, almost record-setting money to go out there and basically be Alex Smith 2.0? And I think that's the thing that Dallas needs to figure out is, you know, is Dak Prescott the future, and can Mike McCarthy take him to a Super Bowl?
Ben, we know the Cardinals got a lot of headlines with their big win in San Francisco over a 49ers team that a lot of people potentially picked to get back to the Super Bowl. But staying in that division, I was really impressed with what the Seahawks did in Atlanta. Not only on defense, Jamal Adams fits like a glove. He was a terror in that secondary. But the fact that Brian Schottenheimer and Pete Carroll finally released Russell Wilson a little more freedom to throw the ball down the field instead of waiting when they're in a close game in the fourth quarter. If he has a little more freedom offensively and with the improvements on defense, could Seattle potentially be, when it's all said and done, the best team in the NFC?
Well, I picked them in New Orleans to play in the NFC Championship, so I'd certainly like to see that. You know, it's interesting to me, when Russ was drafted by the Seahawks, Andy Reid was trying to make a move up to get him. And if he had done that, I mean, think of the numbers Russ would have put up by this point and not being held back by Brian and Pete. You know, we'd be talking about him as a Hall of Famer, and we should be already, but we'd be definitely talking about him as a Hall of Famer in that regard. Russ is one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL. I can't think of, outside of maybe Pat Mahomes, anybody I'd rather have for one game to win me a game than Russell Wilson. I think Seattle's a very good football team, but he'll probably win that division. The Niners are just too banged up right now, I think, to compete. That's going to be a problem for them trying to make a second run at it.
Well, so you talk about the Niners, and you know, I didn't think that they were terrible by any means. I thought Arizona executed on both sides and deserved that win. But I thought Jimmy Garoppolo looked pretty pedestrian in that game. Like, the throw to Kittle was pretty bad, and it ended up with a sprained knee, and he just, you know, missed some throws. I didn't think he was terrific. You know, what's the, I guess, your level of concern there that, you know, he can play at the level that we saw in the regular season last year and get them back to where they were last year and ultimately over the hump?
Well, you know, Jimmy Garoppolo's never been a guy that's been super impressive to me. He's a guy that's more of a point guard than a quarterback that's going to carry you. He needs a strong run game in order to build off of. He doesn't have the strongest arm, doesn't throw well over the middle of the field. Didn't make a lot of mistakes last year, which was nice, but then he got into the playoffs and was kind of a liability for that team. They were trying to hide him at times. I think you need a full complement of receivers out there. I think they've got to get healthy and put a great cast around him in order to, make the run that they want to make in the playoffs this year.
Benjamin, you talk about how teams needed potentially those preseason reps to kind of come together, but the Bucs and Tom Brady just kind of looked a little out of sync still in that game against the Saints team. That defense is so good. It's probably better than their offense, and there wasn't too many yards put up in that game total. The score was a little misleading, but do you think the Bucs can put this all together and be a team that can challenge in the NFC?
It'd be interesting. That defense is better than the offense. It's going to have to carry them. I wasn't a big believer in the whole Tom Brady to Tampa thing. I think that's two conflicting philosophies. Tom wants to get the ball out quick. Bruce Arians wants you to hang in there, seven-step drops, and fling it deep. And that marriage was going to be an interesting one. I don't know. That defense will allow them to stay in football games, and I think they'll be competitive even in a tough division like that. But, I just don't know. I didn't pick them as a playoff team, and I just don't know that that even Tom Brady, even at this point in his career, is going to be able to pull that off for him.
What did you think of the way New Orleans looked, especially offensively? I know they benefited, with a pick six and a short field another time. But Drew Brees' yards per attempt was not particularly impressive. Kamara wasn't great between the tackles. And Brees, he's getting up there in age. We're not sure if he has the arm strength to throw it down the field. What did you make of how that offense and especially Brees looked in week one?
I didn't think they looked as sharp as they needed to. That defense kind of saved their bacon on a couple. I would like to see them get the timing and everything down. Michael Thomas didn't look 100%, and obviously he's going to be out for the next little bit because he's a little banged up. So it's going to be interesting to see if they can use Emmanuel Sanders to overcome that. I know New Orleans really pushed all their chips to the table. They think this is the last year of their window. So, you better hope that offense puts it together because they're betting everything on this year.
Benjamin Albright, host, NFL reporter, analyst for KOA Radio in Colorado. Benjamin, great insight. Thanks for this tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. Take care, guys.
There he goes, Benjamin Albright. Yeah, to me, the Seahawks were the most impressive team out there because, again, that score was misleading because if Matt Ryan isn't a Hall of Fame garbage time quarterback, him and Matt Stafford are first ballot garbage time quarter Hall of Fame quarterbacks because the Falcons made that score a lot more generous than it actually was. And with DK Metcalf there emerging as that big target for Russell Wilson, Chris Carson still, churning out yards. They have a solid run game and getting Jamal Adams. I think that was a trade that happened so late in July and stuff was going on with the NBA and the NHL that it kind of flew a little under the radar. But man, does he fit like a glove in that team. And he was super disruptive in what I saw against the Falcons on Sunday.
Well, it's just it's mind-blowing to me that it took however many years of Pete Carroll and Schottenheimer and Russell Wilson to really just be like, okay, you know what, we're gonna throw the ball down the field here on first and 10 or second and 10 after an incomplete pass. Like, we're not just gonna ram it for 4 yards with Carson like we usually do. And that's not to take away from Carson because he's a great player. He scored 2 touchdowns through the air though, because the threat of the run and obviously Wilson's improv outside the pocket, and the throw to Metcalf was incredible. And it's just where the balls are going to go, right? It's going to go to DK. It's going to go to Lockett. They basically saw every single target. But Wilson's, I'm not sure that anyone throws a better pure ball in the league than Russell Wilson, especially a deep ball. Like, it's just so good. It's in stride. It's perfect, right? Like, the timing is always great, and you have to hope that this is going to carry over, you would think, beyond just week one, right? Like, they're playing the Patriots on Sunday night, who are going to want to try and control the clock with Cam running the ball and not really looking to have these quick drives. They're going to try and have these 10, 15 play drives and milk 7 or 8 minutes off the clock. I'm curious if Seattle's going to deviate at all or if they're going to continue hashtag letting Russ cook, because if that's the case, like, he's going to win MVP and they're going to be right there, I think, with Kansas City as the best team in the league.
Yeah, that's going to be a fascinating Sunday nighter as well between the Patriots and the Seahawks. More NFL talk straight ahead, Josh. We're going to debut a brand new segment, Goldie Berg and the Serbian Bear, where we give you current fairy tales from the League of National Football. We'll do that straight ahead. Sportsnet tonight, George and Josh, along the Sportsnet Radio Network. Tonight, George and Josh along the Sportsnet Radio Network. We're until 1 a.m. later on this hour. The producer of this program is Mark Boffo. He'll jump on for Boffo's late night buffet of topics. I'm feeling a little snacky, Josh. I can't wait to jump into some mozzarella sticks later on in the program. Because if you've had a couple of libations late at night and you're out to have something to eat potentially at like 2:30 in the morning, you know what? I'm going to have some mozzarella sticks as an appetizer. If fried cheese doesn't get you going, I don't think anything else does.
Yeah, I was going to say, especially after your first gym workout in 6 months, why not cap off the day with some mozzarella sticks?
Some delicious mozzarella sticks. All right, we're going to try something new here. I like to try new weird stuff, and our bosses give us the platform late at night at 12:25 to try really weird stuff. And Josh, you and I used to do a segment, Confirm or Deny, on the National Football League. We did it for about 3 years, and we would get texts, oh, you guys are ripping off another show, blah, 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 blah. Whoever had the idea first, we're done with Confirm or Deny. We had a good run, but you and I still love to talk amongst ourselves and the listeners when it comes to the National Football League. That's why I came up with a new spin, Josh. It's called Goldieberg and the Serbian Bear, where we give you current fairy tales from the League of National Football. Danielle, hit the music. Oh, yeah, I like this. Well, our producer of the program, you'll hear him in the late night buffet of topics, Mark Boffo, is going to help us out with this brand spanking new segment. What's going to happen, Josh, is Mark is going to read a current fairy tale from the National Football League, and you and I will say if that take is too hot, too cold, or just right. Producer Boffo, it's story time. Please share.
All right, guys. Well, in the first story, the Eagles of Philadelphia should look to move on from their knight in shining armor under center, Sir Carson Wentz, post-haste. George, what say you?
I think that fairy tale is just too cold.
Porridge is too cold.
Yeah, it's certainly too cold. It's only one game. We know Carson Wentz has dealt with a lot of injuries, and before he suffered that injury in the year of the Super Bowl in 2018, he was on the way to win the MVP, and the offensive line's banged up. He really hasn't had any playmakers around him, especially last season. Zach Ertz, Dallas Goedert, great, but really nothing on the outside. Miles Sanders was even hurt in game one against the Washington football team. I think there's still a lot of leash left on Carson Wentz, even though they drafted Jalen Hurts to potentially be the heir apparent in years to come. But I still think Carson Wentz is still a very good quarterback. What say you, Josh?
I will say that this is too hot.
Oh my, this porridge is too hot.
Like, I get it. You know, he hasn't been maybe as good as that MVP caliber season before he got hurt. And that's the thing, he's always hurt. Like, he gets hurt early on in the wild card game against Seattle last year. He can't stay on the field. But like, if you get rid of Carson Wentz, who are you replacing him with? And is the replacement going to be as good or better? Probably not. This is the thing about quarterbacks in the NFL, is you're always looking for an elite quarterback. And if he's healthy and the offensive line is healthy in front of him, he makes plays and he's in the upper tier of quarterbacks. So he's in the top half of quarterbacks in the league. And by all accounts, like, if you can get a top half of the league quarterback and like maybe a top 12 guy, that's about as good as realistically you're going to do. So all that being said, you know, there are warts there and the injury history is real. You can't turn your nose up at that, because you're not going to do realistically any better, and you're stuck with him. You signed him to a big time deal, and you just got to hope he can stay healthy and maximize the window here and get you back to another Super Bowl.
I like it. Producer Boffo, open the storybook once again, please.
Absolutely. Time for the next fable here, guys. Will the Cardinals of Arizona live happily ever after and not only capture the NFC West, but also represent the National Football Conference in the bowl of super in Solomonoff.
I think this tail is just too hot.
Oh my! This porridge is too hot!
Yeah, again, I love what the Arizona Cardinals did. They went into San Francisco. They beat a very banged up 49ers team. Kyler Murray looked incredible outside of the first half where he was kind of struggling with some of his throws. But the DeAndre Hopkins acquisition is already an absolute slam dunk home run. The offense looks like it's clicking. The defense had its issues at times, but the Niners are still a very good team. The Cardinals are 1 or 2 years away from being, I think, a serious Super Bowl contender. And we've been talking about the Seattle Seahawks. Brian Schottenheimer finally releasing Russell Wilson a little more. That defense with Jamal Adams, it looks finally back to sort of being an elite squad when the defense has kind of been the issue in Seattle the last few seasons. I think the Seahawks and Russell Wilson potentially could represent the NFC in the Super Bowl. I like what Arizona's doing. Could they be a wild card team with 7 teams now in each conference? Sure, but for them to be in the Super Bowl on Super Bowl Sunday in February, I don't think so. What about you, Josh?
Too cold. This one is too cold for me.
Ew! This porridge is too cold.
It's easy to get fired up in week one. They go into San Francisco, they beat the defending NFC champion, and they handled them pretty good. Like, that was a very deserving win, and Kyler looked great, and Hopkins looked great, and you know, Chandler Jones was rushing the passer, and they had a great offseason and all of that. Another year in Cliff Kingsbury's system, but the NFC is tough, man, and that division is especially tough. Like, that, like, Seattle and San Francisco, the Rams, I don't think are going to be a pushover. No game in that division is ever going to be easy. And you don't want to put the cart before the horse here with Arizona. They still got a lot of young players still figuring it out in Kingsbury's system. I could see them making the playoffs and being right there in the race for that division, but Super Bowl representative, I think at least a year too premature for that, so too cold for me.
I like it. Producer Boffo, why don't you share with us another one of your fables?
Absolutely. Well, this one is down in the bayou, guys, and it involves Duke Drew Brees of the Saints of New Orleans. Does he need to ride off into the sunset and live happily ever after?
You know what? I think this take is just right.
This porridge is just right.
I know it's overreactionary a little bit, but man, against Tampa, a team that can get to the quarterback and has a pretty good defense, especially that D-line, but Drew Brees looked old on Sunday. He was 18 of 30 for 160 yards. He has faded the last couple years in the postseason. And yeah, I'm not a Taysom Hill guy. I hate that Sean Payton always mixes him in, seemingly sometimes at the wrong time, to kill the flow of the offense. But you have Jameis Winston waiting in the wings, and if Drew Brees continues to struggle, yeah, I don't think there's a scenario where Sean Payton would actually bench Drew Brees. But this absolutely has to be the last year, because he looks like he's lost at least half a step. What's you, Josh?
I'm right there with you. I think this one is perfect. It's just right.
This porridge is just right.
You probably could have argued that he should have retired after last year. You know, if you really get to him and or more than anything, you make him push the ball down the field, because you know he likes to throw between the numbers to Michael Thomas and check it down to Kamara. But if you force him to really throw the ball down the field, it's not particularly great anymore. It hasn't been for the last couple of years. It's been trending in a bad direction. And like you said, he does seem to maybe run out of steam a little bit down the stretch of some of these seasons. And then the playoffs, like, he was pretty bad in that loss to Minnesota last year in the wild card round. He's no spring chicken anymore. You get to being 41 years old, we shouldn't be surprised if stuff that used to be routine is no longer routine, and more than anything, he may not be able to really do it at all anymore. Maybe they can figure out a way to tailor the offense so they can maximize his diminished arm strength and, you know, continue to put up a lot of points that way, but the margin for error is a lot thinner than it used to be, and, you know, maybe it's Taysom Hill, maybe it's not. Honestly, if I were them, I would have pushed him out the door and kept Teddy Bridgewater, because I think for that offense, Bridgewater, we saw it last year, you know, he can hit the deep throw on occasion, but for that quick hitting offense, mobility as well outside of the pocket, I thought he was a perfect fit, and I feel like that could end up being a bit of a mistake.
Producer Boffo, why don't you regale us with one more tale?
Absolutely. The Bills of Buffalo will stampede into capturing the Eastern American Football Conference for the first time in 25 new moons. What say you, George?
I think this one's just a little too hot.
Oh my! This porridge is too hot!
I would have said this one would have been bang on, but watching what Cam and the Patriots look like in game one, and I know it's the Dolphins, I know it's the Miami Dolphins and Ryan Fitzpatrick, but the way Josh McDaniels just looked rejuvenated on the sideline with this new shiny weapon, and I know they don't have too many weapons on offense, but Cam's very, very motivated to show the world that he can still be that MVP quarterback that we all saw. And Josh, we've all rented a car, or I think a lot of us have rented a car in our lives, and maybe you spend that extra $10 per day on that insurance so you can drive the S out of the car. I think that's what the Patriots are going to do here with Cam Newton. They're not tied to him long term. They don't care if Cam gets hurt. They're going to use Cam Newton for what he is, an absolute physical specimen who can run the football, and you keep the offense on the field for longer, you play more ball control, and let Bill Belichick's defense rest, and he can scheme away against every other team. I was super impressed with how New England looked in week one, and heading into the season, even with the Cam Newton news, I would have told you the Bills are probably going to win this division. I'm just not too sure anymore.
So you make a lot of good points, and that was a very impressive showing from Cam and that offense in week one, but I'm grain of salting it a little bit because it's the Dolphins, right? And the Dolphins are not going to be very good. And maybe I look stupid and Cam has another great week and they beat the Seahawks on the road this week, but yeah, the Bills did exactly what was expected of them. Put up a ton of points. Move the ball with ease. The defense looked good. The fact that Edmonds and Milano are hurt, that's, you know, at least a little bit concerning. But this one's bang on for me.
Ooh.
This porridge is just right.
It's just right. Like, it's... You know, they were the preseason favorite for a reason. You know, they stocked up. They went out and got Diggs. Him and Brown might be the most underrated 1-2 punch at wide receiver in the NFL. Zach Moss looked okay last week. He scored a touchdown. You know, him and Singletary seems like it'll be a good 1-2 punch. If the defense can stay healthy, it's going to be good. And, you know, it really comes down to Allen. And do I think that he can be good enough to win them 10 or 11 games? Yeah, I do. And I think 10, certainly 11 will win you. I think the Patriots are at best a 10-16, maybe 9-7. So I still think that the Bills are the cream of the crop there in the AFC East.
And it's going to be fascinating in that division. But if Cam and the Patriots go into Seattle on Sunday night and pick up the win, look out, Bills Mafia. All of a sudden, the panic of Bill Belichick and the New England Patriots, when their number one nemesis is now in Tampa Bay, but to have the New England Patriots potentially pick up a monster win in Seattle, we're going to see a lot of what those teams are made of. I know it's only week two, and I know you can't overreact to what you see, because now September's a new preseason in the NFL season. But to me, Josh, we're going to learn a lot from both the Seattle and New England on Sunday night.
Yeah, I think that's honestly, you know, there's a couple of good games and a couple of interesting games. That's probably number one, because it's a real, at least on paper, based on how week one went, a clash of styles. But you know, it just seems hard to believe that, that the Patriots will be able to have enough to hang with them. And the defense looked good against Ryan Fitzpatrick, picked him three times and really forced him into a lot of bad throws. But they're missing a lot of big-time players who opted out. They were hit hardest by opt-outs. It's a lot different going up against Russell Wilson, even without fans at CenturyLink there in Seattle. I'm expecting a big-time Seahawks win, like at least by two touchdowns.
What did you guys think? Producer Boffo, weigh in on this. I want your honest opinion, Josh and Mark. What were your thoughts on the inaugural Goldie Berg and the Serbian Bear?
Liked it a lot, I have to say. Like, the music was good, the drops were good, the idea was good. As usual, you usually hit home runs with these kinds of segment ideas, so this looks like a keeper.
Let me just say, there will be absolutely no confusion with this segment. This is an original.
Yeah.
It will not be duplicated anywhere. And sign me up. I'm down for another round of Goldie Bear and the or Goldilocks and the Serbian Goldie, Bear.
Goldie Berg.
Goldie Berg. Sorry. I apologize. Yeah. I'll get it and next time.
And that's how I came up with it, because Josh's name is Goldberg, and Ryan Favreau, assistant program director, directors, called me the Serbian Bear on many occasions. I'm like, I'm going to make a segment over Josh's last name and Favreau calling me the Serbian Bear. I have an idea I want to run past you guys, and we'll do that after the break before we get to Boffo's buffet of topics. One more segment to go. George, Josh, Mark, Danielle on the board. Sportsnet tonight along the Sportsnet Radio Network. /12:44 Sportsnet tonight along the Sportsnet Radio Network. My name is George Russick alongside Josh Goldberg here for another 10 minutes. Boffo's buffet of topics straight ahead. Producer Boffo joining us on the line as well. And gentlemen, we just debuted a new segment, Goldie Berg and the Serbian Bear. So dumb. I have this idea during that segment. I had another idea that popped in my head.
All right. Let's hear it.
And I'm not sure if the bosses would be totally cool with it, but quite frankly, I don't care. But this is my idea, and I think I want to go with it. I think we do an entire show of my stupid segments.
We could do it. we could so, like
you let me run through. Sure. Let me run through everything we could do.
All right.
We could turn back time, right? We could do some coronavirus confessions. We could play It Could Be That, But It Might Be This. We could do some Dragon's Breath, and now Goldie Berg. And the Serbian Bear. What do you guys think?
I still haven't had an opportunity to Dragon's Breath it yet. I hear it's wild.
Me neither. That's what I want to do, too.
I hear it's wild. That's all I've heard.
Yeah, Dragon's Breath is... well, we need to hear some fiery hot takes that only a dragon could spew out.
Yeah.
And our resident dragon, Fanny, spits them out. And they're so hot. Only a dragon can spit them out. I think that's something we do. We do an entire show of all my segments. What do you guys think?
You think we could do 4 hours?
No, we couldn't do 4 hours. It'd have to be like a 2-hour show.
Okay.
Like something after Blue Jays. Like we do Blue Jays, we have some guest on to talk about the Jays, and then we just hammer all these segments in.
We could have done it tonight, for sure. 11-1.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
We could have done it. Yeah.
Right? The Leafs and Raptors are done.
Yeah.
Right? We got NFL. We love NFL. It's top of mind. A ton of NFL fans out there. I host a gambling show Sunday mornings. We talk NFL all day, every day. But outside of the Blue Jays, what really concerns fans in Toronto, yeah, we can say, you know, they're pumped up about the Islanders and Lightning in Game 6 tomorrow and looking forward to the Stanley Cup Final, sure. But I think we could do 2 hours of just all those segments jammed into one show. No guests, just weird segments.
Yeah, I'm all for it at some point because, yeah, we're going to be back without a ton of actual concrete sports here, unfortunately, in the not-too-distant future outside of football, like you said. So, yeah, why not get a little bit weird with it, especially later at night?
Yeah, I think we can absolutely do that. Or we can, you know, when I'm filling in during the day, just do that during the day shift and get angry tweets and texts from people.
Oh,
what are you playing coronavirus confessions for? But who am I kidding? Dragon's Breath is such a winner that it would engulf the listeners of our radio station. Go, why aren't other shows doing this? Because Dragon Breath is fantastic. All right, I'm starving after all of that football talk, some baseball talk. We talked a lot of hoops. The producer's the program, Mark Boffo, and he joins us for the late night edition of Boffo's Buffet of Topics. Mark?
George? Yeah, let's do a show like that. I think it'd be a big hit. I'm down. Sign me up.
Yeah, you don't have to book any guests.
No.
We could actually have maybe, like, somebody come on and play, too. Like, come on and play. It could be that, but it might be this.
Yeah.
Somebody who works late. I think Carly Agar would be a great guest for that.
Sure. Yeah. I think this is something that we should run by the bosses. Let's make it happen.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. Because it's my idea anyway. All right, go ahead. Boffo's Buffet of Topics. Sorry.
All right. This isn't so much a question for you guys. I just kind of wanted to continue on with what you were talking about before with people wearing their masks in the car and how when they're by themselves. You know what's weird, which I agree is odd. I sometimes am in the car and I find myself coming back from a place and I'm like, oh wait, why am I still wearing this 20 seconds later? I don't want to wear it, so I don't know why people do. But the thing for me is the mask being like the new car air freshener, that I just see people have the mask dangling over the rearview mirror, and I'm just like, I don't know, is that healthy? Maybe just put it away or put it down or something.
Yeah.
Why is that? I don't know. That's a weird one for me.
I have seen a bunch of that. It's really strange. People just leaving their disposable mask dangling in their disgusting car, and I guess I'm sure a lot of people are probably just using it over and over. That's what I take out of that.
I have checked. I have asked a medical professional. Apparently, a zipper mask is not appropriate.
Yeah, I think, you know what I think of when I think about a zipper mask? I think about this Pulp Fiction, the scene in the biker shop. Yeah, the Gimp with the zipper mask. It's 12:50. We're talking, I'm mentioning the Gimp from Pulp Fiction. There you go.
I mean, makes sense. He does wear a zipper mask.
Yeah,
all right.
Sure.
Hold on, I got to find, I saw a story somewhere where I think in Australia, they go, if you wear snakeskin or a real snake, that doesn't count as a face covering. I have to look up that story.
Oh, man.
Because who wouldn't want to wear a cobra around their face? You want social distancing? Put a cobra around your face.
Oh, yeah. Nobody's getting within 6 feet of you, for sure.
A snake. All right, anyway, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I was going to just say, looking ahead to tomorrow night, or tonight now, I guess, Thursday night football, underwhelming debut for the Browns in game one, although they did play the Ravens.
Shocker, yeah.
Is Odell Beckham Jr. a member of the Browns by this time next season?
Ooh, I don't think so. I wouldn't be surprised if he's traded midseason, to be honest with you. It's just not working there, and Baker's trying to force him the ball. And Odell's, he's trying, but does he even look as explosive as he did before? Did we not give Eli Manning enough credit that he got him the ball? It just feels like it's not working there. I'm not sure Baker Mayfield's the guy to get him the ball. Who's a team that needs a blockbuster receiver? Could you imagine, guys, if the Packers acquired him to play alongside Devontae Adams, what that would mean for Green Bay? I think that would be something blockbuster. Who's another team that needs a big-time receiver to really flip the script on their team? What about if the Ravens got... Oh, but they would never trade him within the division. But, like, the Ravens would be a team that I would love to see, like an Odell Beckham, a big-time target for Lamar Jackson. He's just a guy that I just don't think Baker's the guy to get him the ball in that offense.
San Francisco, I feel like, has been rumored for so many years.
But
they just drafted.
Can Jimmy G get him the ball?
Also true, right? Like, that's the thing. There's not that many teams that that leap off the page that are like, okay, they'll take the gamble. But yeah, I'm with you. I don't think he'll be on that team this time next year. And I wouldn't be surprised if he's traded midseason. But it's so hard to make those moves. Like, remember when Detroit traded Roy Williams? the receiver Roy Williams to Dallas, yes. And what a disaster that was.
Yeah, I absolutely remember that. He was a fantasy stud for the Lions back in the day.
Yeah, and then a disaster for Dallas.
Yeah, no good.
I mean, I don't know, guys. Huge song, by the way, Danielle. Good call. But I would just say that this has Randy Moss to the Pats kind of vibes to it, where he just goes to the Raiders, flames out, just bad stop in his career, and then the Patriots get him for pennies on the dollar, and he has a complete resurgence. I could see something like that happening, but we'll see.
We know Cleveland and New England's having a relationship, especially on the trade front.
No, it's true. It's true. Just another quick one for you guys.
Yeah.
Edmondson locked up by the Habs after they got his rights from the Hurricanes.
Yeah.
But before the Hurricanes, he was a member of the St. Louis Blues. And I don't want to get too specific here, but will he be the only ex-St. Louis Blues defenseman to play for a Canadian team next season?
Interesting.
I'll say yes.
Referring to Alex Pietrangelo and potentially signing with the Maple Leafs, how can they get him to fit? How is it possible?
They would have to, I guess, like get rid of Janssen and I guess CeCe's cap hits off, but he's going to have to take less money. You're like talking about him taking $7 million. And even then, it's going to be tight. And I just don't see any way that he's doing that. Like, if he's going to take a discount, he's going to do it to stay in the city that he's won a cup, more anonymous. His wife's family's from there. She's from there, obviously. I don't see it. I think he ends up somehow, some way back in St. Louis.
Well, I think if he does end up in Toronto here, I don't think there's any way those Cora forwards are back.
Yeah, I think that's fair. But it's just... Oof,
and I'm not saying Janssen. I'm talking about... Matthews isn't going to get traded. Tavares isn't going to get traded. It's either going to be Marner or Nylander who are gone to make room for Alex Pietrangelo. There's no way they can have those four guys and Alex Pietrangelo. Oh, and by the way, the one thing that nobody's really talking about, how much money is Morgan Rielly going to make coming up?
A lot. $8 million. You would think $7.5 million minimum.
And the cap's not going anywhere. Brian Burke's been saying it's gonna be at this level for the next 5 years.
Yikes. That's a disaster for the Leafs. It's a disaster for a lot of teams.
Absolute.
But it's a disaster for the Leafs.
Boffo, terrific work. Thanks for this, pal.
Hey, thanks for hitting me with the truth with those questions, guys.
No problem. Josh, I don't know when we're doing another show together.
Hopefully soon.
In the near future.
Yeah.
So we can bust out Goldie Berg and the Serbian Bear. Thanks to Danielle Furtado. Great job behind the board. CBS Sports Radio will watch you while you sleep.